You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, April 25th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, physicist, climate scientist Michael Mann, author of The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. On The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. Also on the program today, the destroy some tape on torture, you get a book deal. Talk about torture, you go to jail. That seems to be the era of accountability we're living in. Also, some good news out of Pennsylvania's 17th district. The war on women continues. The war on people continues. As Great Britain, in a double-dip recession, it's like magic. All you need to do is cut economic activity, i.e. austerity, and economic activity goes down. It's stunning how that works. First up, today is the 25th anniversary of the AIDS activist group ACT UP, or AIDS Coalition to Unleash the Power. And to celebrate, they are, I think, as we speak, joining Occupy Wall Street and occupying Wall Street. They're marching today in New York City from City Hall and working their way down the financial district. They are joined in that coalition, like I say, by Occupy Wall Street, also Housing Works, Health Gap, National Nurses United, Occupy Wall Street, Healthcare for the 99% Working Group, Visual Aids, Queering OWS, Queerocracy, just a whole bevy of groups. And they are calling for a financial speculation tax, which could mean potentially hundreds of billions of dollars. It would not affect, of course, your regular bank transactions. It would not affect individual investors. But it would place a tiny, tiny, tiny fractional tax, a fraction of 1%, on speculative trading by Wall Street investment banks, hedge funds, and other large institutions. And they're calling for the proceeds of that tax to go towards providing funding, more funding, for the horribly inadequate funding that we've provided for AIDS research and care in this country. ACT UP, joining with Occupy Wall Street a mere six, seven days before the actions that are planned for May 1st. And some other good news, briefly, don't follow a lot of electoral things that happen on this program, as we have other fish to fry these days. But the Blue America candidate, Blue America PAC is that PAC that has been set up by, I think, Digby and Crooks and Liars and Howie Klein. And they were the first, I believe, national progressive group to endorse Matt Cartwright. And he beat Blue Dog Tim Holden in Pennsylvania's 17th district. Holden was the incumbent, although the district was redrawn. But when Howie Klein says that Matt Cartwright is a true blue progressive, as it were, I believe him. Nobody's done more in this arena in fighting to get progressive candidates elected in Congress than Howie Klein. And according to a statement by Howie Klein, our next stop is Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District, where progressive businessman Rob Zurban is battling to defeat Republican poster boy Paul Ryan in a swing district. So good news on that front. Pennsylvania is shaping up to be quite a state for the Democrats. And so we will keep our eyes on that. In the meantime, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Michael Mann, author of The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, in just a moment. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to this program Dr. Michael Mann. He is a professor at Penn State University. He was the lead author on the Observed Climate Variability and Change chapter of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. This is the IPCC, the third scientific assessment report in 2001. He was the organizing committee chair for the National Academy of Science, Frontiers of Science, in 2003. He is the man who developed the hockey stick graph and author of The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, because one certainly led to another, didn't it, Michael?
Sense. It sort of escalated the wars, if you will. There has been an ongoing attempt by certain vested interests to try to discredit the science linking climate change and the emission of carbon into the atmosphere, the burning of fossil fuels and the emission of carbon into the atmosphere. There has been an effort for several decades now to try to discredit the science linking our human activity to climate change.
All right. Well, let's back up just a little bit, because I am not terribly scientifically prolific. And, you know, when it comes to climate change, I simply look at what the preponderance of the scientists say. And because I have some faith in science and scientists, that's essentially I take that warning at face value. But what is the hockey stick graph?
So the hockey stick graph was this graph that we produced more than a decade ago. It was an attempt to extend the temperature record back in time, because we only have widespread thermometer measurements around the globe going back about a century. And so from those data, we know that the globe has warmed about a degree and a half Fahrenheit over the past century. But what that instrumental record doesn't tell us is how unusual is that sort of warming? Is it possible that that sort of warming happens naturally from one century to the next? And so to try to address questions like that, my co-authors and I used indirect measures of climate, what we call proxy data. These are things like tree rings and the layers of growth of coral, ice cores, various indirect measures of climate that we can turn to try to estimate how the climate changed farther back into the past. And by analyzing those sorts of data, we determined that the globe was relatively warm about 1,000 years ago. It cooled into the depths of what we call the Little Ice Age into the 17th through 19th centuries. So if you want, you could think of that as a long handle, a downward tilting handle. And then over the past century, of course, the globe warmed. And you might think of that as the blade, the two of them together forming something that looks sort of like a hockey stick. And what the blade, the end of the record indicated was that the current warmth appears to be unprecedented as far back as we were able to go, 1,000 years. And since then, many other studies have come to the same conclusion. But keep in mind, this is just one piece of evidence for the reality of human-caused climate change. There are literally dozens of independent lines of evidence, and it's because of that. It's because there are many different lines of evidence. It's because not just one or two or a handful of scientists, but scientists around the world agree that climate is changing and that we're responsible for it. That's the reason that we accept the conclusions of the scientific community. It isn't just because of one 10-year-old study by me and my co-authors.
Right. That is exactly the point, isn't it? Is because it is this is a body of evidence that far is incredibly transcendent of one person. And one study. Now, let me just ask one question here. Now, when you take, you check tree rings when you measure coral, when you measure ice core, you do this from disparate geographic locations. Is that right?
That's right, although I have to confess, my job's sort of easy. I make use of all the hard work that other paleoclimate scientists have done for decades to try to recover these amazing records around the world, coral records from the tropical oceans, the southern hemisphere, the northern hemisphere, ice cores from the North Pole, the South Pole, and high elevation regions, even in the tropics where ice exists, like Mount Kilimanjaro, and tree ring records from the continents. And so because there is this wealth of data that has been produced by a community-wide effort, paleoclimate scientists working to produce, these very large data sets that scientists like myself have been able to draw upon that work and to try to synthesize the information contained within all those records. And so that's ultimately, what we did. It led to this figure, the hockey stick. Like I said, it's right. Not the pillar of evidence that our detractors would like you to think. It's not like the case for climate change rests on this, but it was an iconic figure. It told a simple story. You didn't need to understand the physics of how a climate model works to understand what this graph was telling you. And I think it became a potent image, especially to our critics, to those looking to discredit the science linking human activity and climate change.
And I asked that question about the disparate regions of the world that data comes from, because often we'll hear someone claiming that the ice core of Greenland or something,
right,
shows something different. But you can't measure from just, or I should say, it's not as accurate or it's not as solid evidence when you're talking about one specific tiny area.
No, absolutely. And I'll give you an example. Right now I'm in Vienna for a scientific conference, and when you talk to the Europeans, it's actually been a relatively cool winter here. Not a record-breaking cold year, just sort of an average relatively cold winter. If you only had records for Europe, you would have no idea that we have been breaking all-time records for warmth throughout the U.S. Over the past several months. In fact, we've set new records standards for high temperatures around the country. You know, in terms of the number of high temperature records that we've been breaking over the past few months, it's unprecedented for the U.S. So, you know, you wouldn't know that if you were just in Europe or if you were just in Greenland, for example. And what you have to do is synthesize information from around the globe, because a lot of the things that influence climate regionally, like the El Nino phenomenon, they do things like they change the pattern of the jet stream, or they change the directions of ocean currents. And those sorts of things don't necessarily change the average temperature of the globe very much, but they do redistribute heat. They do cause certain regions to warm while other regions cool. And so you really have to average over all of the different regions to really figure out what the global temperature is actually doing.
Right. I mean, that's one of the reasons why, I mean, I get so frustrated with the notion of someone saying, you know, it's snowing out. It must be, there's no global warming. Or even, frankly, you know, the march that we had in New York was ridiculously warm. But I hesitate to say I can experience in an immediate fashion and know that this is a function of global warming. You need to really look at it in a much broader context.
No, exactly, and that's and you can sort of do that. I mean, with the you know with the records we've seen over the past few months. So if you point to any one day that was you know unusually warm, you know in March in Washington D.C. or New York, you know that's weather, right? It's the random rolls of the weather dice. But what climate change is doing is it's loading those dice. Okay, so we're seeing sixes appearing far more often than they ought to, and if you look at the entire past decade, it turns out that those sixes are coming up twice as often as they should with a fair die. We're breaking all-time warmth records at twice the rate we would expect in the absence of climate change. For the first 3 months of this year, we are breaking those records at 20 times the rate that we would expect if there had been no climate change. And the climate models that we use to try to project what, you know, will happen in the future say that this record-breaking warm winter, that will be business as usual. It will be a typical winter and a typical spring if we continue on this course that we're on with fossil fuel burning and warming of the globe.
All right. Now, so let's move to the other part of let's move, you know, specifically to your book. And it details and it walks us through the relentless attacks that you have been under because I think in many respects, because the hockey stick graph was so iconic and so easy to digest that rather than its scientific implications, it's almost I think you were attacked because of its effectiveness in expressing what was going on in a way that most of us can understand. Tell me what the Serengeti strategy is, and as you describe it in your book, and how you were subjected to it.
Yeah, I was, in fact, that's very much what I was thinking about as you were sort of framing the issue. You know, there has been this effort for some time. It didn't start with me. My good friend and colleague Ben Santer from the Lawrence Livermore Laboratory in California played an influential role in the second assessment report of the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, back in 1995, and he was fiercely attacked. There were op-eds that appeared in the Wall Street Journal attempting to discredit him, to challenge his integrity, to smear him, essentially. And the same thing happened with me in when the hockey stick became a prominent sort of icon in the climate change debate. Those looking to discredit the science, and many of them are allied with fossil fuel industry front groups and organizations that are using the same playbook that the tobacco industry used decades ago to try to discredit the science linking, you know, their product with human health impacts like lung cancer. Well, what we've had more recently is groups allied with the fossil fuel industry trying to discredit the science linking their product, fossil fuels, with the health of the planet. And so we came, you know, my work, because that the hockey stick was became an icon in the climate change debate, this Serengeti strategy that I refer to is this strategy to isolate a single scientist, try to make it sound like the entire weight of evidence rests on that one scientist. So you set up this straw man that the science of climate change is this house of cards, you know, resting on a single 10-year-old hockey stick study and a single scientist like me, who published the study, when in fact the reality is that very much the opposite of a house of cards. The science is like a puzzle, right? There's still things we're trying to figure out. We don't have all the answers, but it's like a puzzle that's mostly filled in, and we can see the picture. And sure, there are a few pieces that are missing, but it's not going to change the overall picture of the fact that, you know, we are changing the climate, we're warming the globe. But if you can set up this straw man, as those seeking to undermine the science have sought to do, to make it seem like it all depends on one person, then you focus all of your, you know, all of the attacks on this one person. You try to discredit them, you try to make an example of them for their colleagues, to say to their colleagues, if you come out, if you participate in, you know, in the public discourse on this issue, then we will do the same thing to you. I think it's to send a message to other scientists, to make an example of me, to warn them that if you know, if your science plays a prominent role in the case for human-caused climate change, if you participate in the public discourse, in the public sphere, talking about this issue, we're going to come after you too. And it's much the way that, you know, lions of the Serengeti will try to pick off an individual animal at the edge of a herd rather than try to take down. They know they can't take down the whole herd, but they'll go for that vulnerable animal at the edge of the herd. And they try to do the same thing. Climate change deniers try to do the same thing with scientists.
You know, it's interesting because I actually, I mean, in my experience, and this past weekend I was on I was on a cable show sitting next to Christine Todd Whitman, and who, as you know, is the former governor of New Jersey and former chief of George Bush's EPA. And, you know, we were talking about the issue of conservatives. And there's a recent study that came out maybe a month or two ago showing that not only do conservatives have less faith in science and have had decreasing faith in science over the past 25 years or so, but the most educated conservatives have actually had the greatest increase in skepticism of science in general.
Right.
And I think that there's been a concerted effort to attack science, both for the subsidiary benefits if you're an industry, whether it's tobacco, whether it's whether you're a pharmaceutical company, or whether you're putting out pesticides, or whether you're involved in you know, carbon, putting carbon into the atmosphere, but also it undermines the notion that we as a society can collectively work towards a solution for any of these problems.
Yeah, and it's a great point. And, you know, it's interesting you mentioned Christine Todd Whitman because, of course, she had a very forward looking view about the challenge of climate change and carbon emissions when she was EPA administrator for George W. Bush in his first term. And she was forced out.
Mm-hmm.
She was forced out of the EPA by others within the administration who didn't want to hear about the challenge that we face, the need to deal with our carbon emissions, who in many cases were essentially acting as advocates for the fossil fuel industry rather than advocates for the good of the people that they're representing. And it's, you know, there are a number of, you know, very forward-looking, pro-science, pro-environment Republicans, you know, out there. And one of the things that I think your readers would find interesting about my book, The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, is that you might be surprised to learn that the greatest hero in our story who came out to defend us against the attacks by the forces of climate change denial, the greatest hero in our story was a Republican. It was Sherwood Bollert. He was the chair of the House Science Committee. He was a pro-environment, pro-science, northeastern moderate Republican from New York. And when Joe Barton of Texas came out and tried to enforce a subpoena demanding all of my email correspondences with dozens of other scientists around the world, it was Sherwood Bullard who really came out and challenged his own fellow Republican, denounced what was clearly to be an attempt to intimidate scientists whose findings were inconvenient to the special interests that fund his campaigns. And people like John McCain also came out to defend us against these attacks. And you have Bob Inglis, South Carolina, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and I could go on. You know, there are a number of Republicans who have taken a pro-science, rational approach to this problem. We can have a good faith debate about what to do about the problem of climate change. We can no longer have a good faith debate about the reality of the problem. And I think it's unfortunate that we do seem to be stuck in the latter right now.
Yeah, let's talk. I mean, there's two things I want to talk about. I want to stay on this. I do want to get to the so-called climate gate, email gate, whatever that was. But
sure.
But you know, I want to stay on this topic because, you know, I think Bullard ultimately, and he was from upstate New York here. He ultimately, I think, decided not to run again because I think he saw that within his own party he was getting that type of pushback. In fact, you know, Christine Todd Woodman, she said to me that she thought the problem, the reason why there's been diminished, and you know, studies show, I think there was a Yale survey that showed yep. that the number of people who actually now perceive climate change to be a function of man has actually gone down in the past 3 or 4 years. She claimed that it was a function of the flipness of people who promote climate change science. And I, rather than getting into, you know, talking about Christine Todd Whitman, because I just right. don't even know how one replies to something like that.
Right.
But what is it? What needs to be done? I mean, why has this change happened? There's no less science. In fact, there's more science.
I think I caught that segment. I think it was on the Chris Hayes show.
Exactly.
I caught the segment. I was very surprised when she said that.
Yeah, you should have seen us during the break.
Nothing could be further from the truth. You know, I mean, there are, of course, advocates on both sides of the debate who have their own agenda. But in terms of the fundamental science and scientists who are speaking out about this, we're simply talking about what the scientific evidence shows and what implications it has. And, you know, I don't see my role as a climate scientist to prescribe policy. I'm not telling policymakers they should pass a carbon tax or they should pass cap and trade. I'm happy to leave that to the politicians and the will of the people they represent. But I do believe that scientists have a role in making sure that that debate, that policy debate, that, you know, worthy debate about what to do about the problem is informed by an honest discussion of what the scientific evidence shows. And unfortunately, in the comments that Governor Whitman made, it sounded like she was actually confusing two different things, advocating for an honest discussion of the science and what the scientific evidence holds and what its implications are, which I don't think any scientist should apologize for, and policy advocacy, which is not what people like me, what my colleagues are doing. So I do think that she drew a false equivalence between those two things. And it's unfortunate because otherwise she's been a very positive voice within her party, the Republican Party, when it comes to this issue.
Yeah, I mean, I think it seems to me that there is something almost inherently that scientists are at an inherent disadvantage because despite the fact that the conservative movement would have us believe that you're all in this because of the huge riches you're making by coming to these conclusions and these cottage industries that you have and whatnot. The fact is that there's a tremendous amount of resources on the side of confusing and muddying the waters.
Yep.
And that is their job. I mean, they are trained at this, and whereas scientists are trained to do science.
Right. In fact, they're so good at it that they've managed to convince the public that, you know, it's the scientists, it's us who have some well-funded machine behind us when, you know, in fact, you know, we all live quite modestly. You know, our grant money doesn't go into our pockets. It helps support our research programs so that we can, you know, fund students and publish papers. So there's this mythology that's been created by our detractors that somehow scientists are gaining personally from this. That, you know, somehow climate science is a love fest, and we're all just trying to reinforce each other's findings about the reality of climate change, when in fact it's far more like, you know, science is a contact sport, okay, as one colleague of mine put it. You know, you get three of us in a room, and it would be hard to get us to agree about anything, because the way you get ahead in science isn't by proving the other person right. It's by proving the other person wrong, by finding something new that we didn't know. And so the incentive structure in science is to actually try to find the things that don't make sense, to try to explain the anomalies, not to simply reinforce the prevailing, you know, paradigm. So the other side has been very effective in completely fooling the public about, you know, the way science works, what the incentive is as a scientist. And, you know, and it's ironic because the other side is, detail in my book. I mean, I was very interested to learn, who are these people who are attacking me, who are trying to smear me, who are subjecting me to legal assaults? Where's this coming from? And as I followed the trail, it inevitably led back to a small number of conservative think tanks, like the Koch brothers, the K-O-C-H, Koch mm-hmm. brothers, like the Scaife foundations, certain conservative foundations and groups that are allied with the fossil fuel industry, who are essentially waging a massive campaign to try to smear my climate scientist colleagues and me, to try to fool the public about the reality of the problem, so that we'll hopefully, as far as they're concerned, just bury our heads in the sand rather than, you know, act now. And ultimately, you know, I have a 6-year-old daughter. My Republican friends, as much as my Democratic friends, you know, I don't imagine for a moment that they don't care equally about the world that we leave our children and grandchildren. So it shouldn't be a partisan political issue. It's about making the right decisions now so that we don't leave our children and grandchildren a degraded planet. And it's hard to understand how there can be a partisan divide on that issue.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think at the end, you're right. There are forces out there that do have an incentive to muddy these waters, and it's an economic incentive, of course. And when you talk about the skepticism, I mean, that's almost the definition of science.
Oh yeah, absolutely. All scientists should be skeptics, true skeptics. That means, you know, when subject to a new finding or new claim, you know, you examine it, you scrutinize it, and you look for the holes. But you do so in an equal-sided way. And a lot of those who would like to call themselves skeptics are nothing of the sort, because they are willing to attempt to attack and discredit mainstream scientific findings like the greenhouse effect, which is 2-century-old science. It's fundamental physics and chemistry, despite what, you know, you might hear from those looking to attack the science. And so they're willing to attack basic physics, established physics and chemistry, with the flimsiest of arguments that don't stand up to the slightest bit of scrutiny. Now, that's not skepticism. That's one-sided skepticism or contrarianism, or in its, you know, worst form, what I call denial. And, you know, I think it's, you have to call a spade a spade. Those who are attempting to deny established science are deniers. They don't like the term. They'd like to be called skeptics, but they're not skeptics. They're deniers.
And I want to touch on this. In 2009, there were the University of East Anglia, the climatic research unit, was the emails were hacked, and your emails were fairly prominent in the attempts to discredit climate science across the board. Just tell us about that episode.
Yeah, well, the most remarkable thing is that it was an email that wasn't written by me and wasn't about me. that was most used to try to discredit me, and that gives you some idea of how dishonest an endeavor this was. And so, you know, I don't think it's coincidental that this all took place just weeks before the Copenhagen summit of December 2009, the first real opportunity in years to make meaningful progress on dealing with the problem of climate change. And in the weeks leading up to that summit, there was this criminal, there was this release of stolen, of criminally, obtained emails, thousands of emails between climate scientists around the world. And they were selectively leaked and quoted, cherry-picked, and quotes and phrases strung together in a way that didn't even appear in the emails to try to make it sound like climate scientists were cooking the data, like climate change was indeed the elaborate hoax that people like James Inhofe of Oklahoma would like us to believe. And so this all played out just weeks before the Copenhagen summit, and it was almost certainly used as an attempt to distract the public and policymakers to take their eye off the ball at this critical moment in history. And, you know, it potentially set us back years in terms of confronting this problem. And every year we wait, every year where we do nothing to bring our emissions to a peak and begin bringing them down, it makes it that much more difficult to stabilize greenhouse gas levels below dangerous levels. And so there's a real cost. There's a real cost, not just to us, but to the planet in these attempts to distract the public, to delay action, and to commit us to greater and greater amounts of climate change.
And so, and I should say that not only do you outline this the so-called the ClimateGate the emails and contextualize them in your book, but there were three separate independent investigations that basically said there's nothing here. Is that right? British Parliament.
That's wrong, Sam. That's wrong. There were eight investigations now, including the National Science Foundation's investigator general, inspector general, the highest authority in the country when it comes to matters of scientific misconduct. And they specifically looked at all of the claims that climate change deniers were making about me and others, and they said that, you know, there's nothing to them. These are fabricated accusations and allegations. But you know what? It took, you know, 2 years, 2.5 years for that, right, to play out. In the meantime, those looking to, to discredit us and the science achieved their goal of sidetracking the discussion of climate change for years, of scuttling not only any possibility of progress at Copenhagen, but of scuttling any serious attempt to deal with the problem of climate change in the U.S. Congress as well. And, you know, to me, some people have said, well, you know, isn't that a crime against humanity, what they're doing? My view is it's more than that. It's a crime against the planet. It's a new sort of crime, because what they are doing is basically leading us astray and preventing us from taking the actions that we need to be taking now to make sure that we don't, you know, leave future generations a fundamentally degraded planet.
Is there room in the discussion? Is there a space for a new version of the hockey stick graph? Is there another? I mean, is there an opportunity to take that back, or is it simply something that is going to take something more than an argument, more than an icon, more than a movie, let's say, that it's simply going to be people are just going to have to start realizing that when we start to see massive droughts in the middle of this country, let's say, and you know, we start getting more and more marches that are like May used to be, and
right,
June
used to be. And our Mays are going to be like July used to be, and our Julys, you know, there's no analog for what they're going to be like if we continue on this path. No, you're absolutely right, and I think that you alluded to this earlier, that as scientists and as those trying to communicate the science, sometimes we tend to make the incorrect assumption that the only thing that's preventing us from breaking through, from communicating the nature of the threat, is the information, that if we just throw enough facts at people that they'll get it. And unfortunately, I don't think that's necessarily true because we're just trying to barnstorm through that front door with facts. And in many cases, the front door is closed and it's bolted. And people are not, some of those who, you know, believe that this is a hoax, that it's a manufactured problem, climate change, I don't believe they're coming at it from a rational point of view or a factually based point of view. I think they're coming at it from, in many cases, an ideological point of view. Right. If you accept the reality of climate change, then at some level you have to accept the fact that there are hidden costs of our reliance, our current reliance on fossil fuels, and that somehow we need to build into the economy the damage that our reliance on fossil fuels is doing to the planet. So if you accept that, then, you know, it forces you at some level to accept the need for some sort of regulation of our carbon emissions. And for those who ideologically are opposed to any such attempts to regulate, you know, corporate behavior, they've already decided they have to be against it. And so they're going to work back to find the facts, the quote-unquote facts, that they need to try to justify their position. And that's not the way it should be. You look at the facts first,
right,
and hopefully that informs your policy decisions. You don't start with the policy and work backward to figure out what the science has to be to justify it, and how much you need to contort what the science actually says. And I think those who deny climate change are doing that. They're attempting to distort and contort the scientific evidence to suit an ideological agenda.
I mean, I have to say, it's very rare you hear an argument against the idea that the planet is warming that that is framed around the notion of this is why the scientists are wrong because of X, Y, and Z. It always involves there has to be some type of secret cabal, and these scientists are willfully, because there's no, it's a much harder thing to argue that in some fashion the actual science is wrong. Tell us what percentage of climate scientists, because the polling of this is really rather disturbing, but tell us what percentage of climate scientists, to the extent that can be measured, which I think is fairly easy to measure, actually, what percent subscribe to this notion that we are in a crisis mode with the amount of carbon that we're putting into the atmosphere?
Well, you know, at some level, crisis, you know, is potentially a value-laden term, and so it's hard to address that specifically from a scientific point of view.
All right. Well, then let me rephrase that in a less flip way, so that if the governor is listening, she will be able to accept this. The increase in carbon beyond the 350 parts per million, which is considered a tipping point, is a man-made. Is a function of human activity.
No, I knew what you were getting at, and you know, so the proposition that we are warming the planet noticeably and changing the climate noticeably, and that we will see far larger impacts and potentially quite detrimental impacts if we proceed on this course, that is not legitimately contested in the scientific community. So I'm here at a meeting in Vienna, the European Geophysical Union, thousands of scientists from Europe and the U.S. and other countries who get together every year to talk about the latest, you know, developments in the science. And, you know, and I've been attending talks. Nobody is debating whether no scientists are debating whether the planet is warming or whether increasing greenhouse gas concentrations are responsible for it or whether humans are responsible for those increases in greenhouse gas concentrations. That's not what scientists are debating. What we're debating is what will be the impact on, for example, hurricanes in the Atlantic Ocean and how much warming. We know we're going to get a certain amount of warming, but precisely how much warming will we get? And what's the impact going to be on rainfall patterns in, you know, Pennsylvania? I mean, there are areas of the science where we don't have certain answers, and scientists are still debating and working out the science and trying to figure these things out. But there's literally, you know, no debate within the scientific community about whether humans are warming the planet by burning fossil fuels and increasing the greenhouse gas concentrations. But if you listen to the public discourse on this issue, you would get the you would come to the, you know, conclusion that the scientific community is divided on this issue. And it just speaks to how effective the campaign to deny the science of climate change has been, that they've been able to take an issue where there is about as much, you know, agreement agreement as you'll ever find on a scientific issue within among the scientists around the world. The U.S. National Academy of Sciences, founded by Abraham Lincoln, a Republican president, I might add, or the National Academies of all the major industrial nations, all the G8 nations, are all on record as saying that climate change is real and the impacts could potentially be quite damaging and we need to do something about it. But you would never gather that from the public discussion that we're still having in the U.S.
Indeed. Michael Mann, the author of The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
All right, folks. Happy days.
High on a hill was a lonely goat herd.
We may need about. We may need to play the whole album. We may have to. We may have to play the whole movie. All right, folks. That is our. Stop the music. I want to read an email. Stop the music. Now I can't find the email. Seriously? Can I really not find that? Oh, here it is. I want to read you folks an email because day to day, it's rare that I get people who say nice things to me. I'm sorry. That's just the case. And so when someone takes the time to write me an email, I will read it. Emily writes, "Dear Sam," which is also, how many times do you get an email these days that starts with "Dear anything"? "The show has just been stellar recently." She's obviously not a longtime listener, but I've really been appreciating your interviews as well as your own commentary. It has just been spot on. The tipping point for me realizing how much I appreciate your work was an absolutely fantastic question you asked Darren Acemoglu. I can't believe I just pronounced that correctly. He was talking about lobbying and money in politics, and you asked him a really fantastic question about how then, given what he was saying, did it fit in with the institutional explanation in his book? And I had the thought that you really do your homework and pay attention to what your interviewees are saying and ask really great questions. And your interview with Thomas Frank was delightful, and your discussions with Cliff Schechter have been just great. And this morning's discussion about the myths of Social Security was just so insightful and refreshing. I got to double check this email because this could actually be from my mom. "I hadn't previously signed up to be a member because I could barely keep up with the show on a daily basis. And I hate, in asterisks, listening to people call into radio shows." I guess you really hate it. "So I thought about my contribution totally selfishly, i.e., why would I pay for the better half when I don't need it and I'm already getting great stuff? But lately I've realized that the free show is just so good." And that's her emphasis. She capitalized "so." "That I should be willing to be a member just for that part of it. It's irrelevant whether or not I want the other part. Your show is good enough to be worthy supporting without it. If I don't at least try to be a member, it means I'm a thankless jerk who free rides on my community, and that's not who I want to be." Emily goes on to talk about how she's going through some financial troubles, as is her husband, but she still intends to become a member. So I put it to you, Emily or Edward Q. Public. I got to double check it. That sounds like a family member who wrote that. But assuming it's not, I put it to you, is your financial situation so dire that you cannot become a member to support just the first half of the show? Do I need to cut it down to 7 minutes so that getting 40 minutes a day for free seems like a deal? Or excuse me, for whatever, $10 a month, it seems like a deal? Maybe. I hope not. So please, folks, if you can become a member, head over to majority.fm now. Sign up. We really could use your support in ways that it's almost impossible for me to express.
without freaking people out. So let me leave it that way. Oh, thank you, Matt. That was nice. Matt's back, folks. Not a moment too soon. You can join us in the better half. But even if you don't become a member, please. Of course, we always have justcoffee.coop, coffee, tea, chocolate, fair trade. 10% discount, coupon code, majority. It's great stuff. That's a win-win situation, folks. And, of course, we have you can head over to majority.fm and click support the show and find other ways of supporting the show, including, I don't know, get some merchandise if you want it. Buy your Amazon junk through our link. Give us a review on iTunes. DonateYourAccount.com. So many different ways you can help. But as the, I think it's the Midrash or the Mishnah or the Haftorah. Somebody somewhere said, but the greatest way of supporting of them all is to become a member. All right, see you in the better half. You can IM me at Majority FM. You can call me at 646-257-3920. Coming up in the better half, talk more about this former CIA spy who is profiting off of his destruction of tapes showing CIA torture. More on the war on women. And really interesting news on the immigration front. Mexican immigration in this country is now net negative. Yeah. Yeah. We'll be right back in just a moment.